Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world, and we tell these stories in a way that makes them easier to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about human rights abuses within the seafood industry in Thailand. It involves one of the largest food companies in the world. Then some science news, as nature comes to the rescue to help us get rid of some dangerous chemicals from a product that seems to be everywhere. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Mario Ritter joins us with our first story.
A Vietnamese fisherman was killed last week while working in the contested waters of the South China Sea. His boat and the 13 surviving crew members returned to the port of Sa Kỳ on Tuesday. They said they were attacked by 8 men on 2 speedboats while fishing near the Spratly Islands. The nationality of the attackers is not known, but Vietnamese authorities promised a thorough investigation of the incident. The attack underscores the difficult conditions faced by Asian fishermen in a largely unregulated industry. Not only do fishermen face attacks like these, they work under difficult conditions. In fact, Nestle SA, one of the world's biggest food companies, says it is looking into the labor practices of some of its seafood suppliers in Thailand. Nestle SA started investigating the lives of workers after news reports about bad conditions on fishing boats, docks, and at processing plants in Thailand. Nestle reported its findings in November. The report described how poorly some of Nestle's suppliers treated their workers. Migrant workers from poor countries near Thailand were sold into forced labor. They were lured by promises of better income. But when they arrived to work, they were forced to catch and process fish that end up in the supply chains of Nestle and other global food companies. The workers receive little rest, often working 16-hour days, and little health care. The workers are also charged fees to be able to work, and that eats into their low pay. Nestle hired an independent organization called Verite to report on the working conditions in Thailand. Verite spoke with 100 people familiar with the seafood industry in Thailand, including 80 workers from Cambodia and Myanmar. One worker from Myanmar, also known as Burma, said he saw workers pulled into the sea by heavy nets and left for dead. If someone died on a fishing trip, he would be thrown overboard instead of given a proper burial, the worker said. Another worker said he had been working on a fishing boat for 10 years without being able to accumulate any savings. "I am barely surviving," he said. Verite interviewed workers, boat captains, and managers in Thailand. It confirmed the stories of a violent and dangerous seafood industry that exports $7 billion of products each year. Verite found underage workers were using fake identities to get work. Verite said, abuse begins as workers are recruited, hired, and employed. Nestle says it does not do that much business in Southeast Asia, but some seafood in a popular cat food comes from Thailand. The food giant warns that many of the world's big food companies run the risk of buying seafood from suppliers who abuse their workers. Some analysts are impressed by the report. Mark Lagan is the president of Freedom House, an organization that fights human trafficking and slave labor. He called the report unusual and exemplary. He noted that most companies would not look into their business practices or make the information public. They would fear being sued in a lawsuit, he said. Customers have filed lawsuits to force food companies to reveal where food comes from. For example, consumers who buy food for pets have filed lawsuits against Nestle and other major companies that process food from overseas. The customers said they would not buy food that was caught by forced labor. The lawsuits aim to reveal the source so consumers can make choices about what they buy. Magdi Batato is Nestle's head of operations. He said in a statement that forced labor and human rights abuses have no place in our supply chain. Nestle posted its report online and promised to report its progress each year. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to As It Is, a daily radio show and podcast from the Voice of America. Now it is Ann Ball's turn to tell us about a small animal that is helping in the worldwide fight against pollution. Ann?
Styrofoam is a plastic with a bad reputation. It cannot be recycled without releasing dangerous pollution into the air. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says it is the fifth largest creator of hazardous waste. Worms to the rescue, specifically mealworms. Scientists from the U.S. and China have discovered that mealworms can digest plastic. One mealworm can digest a pill-sized amount of plastic a day. Study co-author Wei Min Wu says that in 24 hours, the plastic is turned into carbon dioxide. Are the worms hurt by eating plastic? The study found that worms eating styrofoam were as healthy as worms eating bran. The researchers will study the worms' eating habits and look to duplicate the plastic breakdown, but on a larger scale. Styrofoam, or polystyrene, is a lightweight material, about 95% air, with very good insulation properties, according to earthsource.org. It is used in products from cups that keep your beverages hot or cold, to packaging material that protects items during shipping. Solving the issue of plastic pollution is important, says Wu, a Stanford University environmental engineering instructor. Landfill space is becoming limited, he says. About 33 million tons of plastic are thrown away in the United States every year. Plastic plates, cups, and containers take up 25% to 30% of space in America's landfills. One styrofoam cup takes more than 1 million years to recycle in a landfill, according to Cleveland State University. I'm Ann Ball.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A surprising new study says minority students in the UK are more likely to go to college than their poor white classmates. In fact, poor white British students are the least likely of all groups to go to university. The researchers said they were surprised by what they found. White British students did not have the highest educational attainment at school. Attainment means how well students show knowledge and skills on tests. Poor white British students' participation rate at university was much lower than ethnic minorities. Ellen Greaves is one of the authors.
That was a very interesting and surprising finding. The proportion of pupils from Pakistani, from Bangladeshi, from Black Caribbean groups, who all have typically lower attainment on average, for them to be going in much higher rates onto university was the big surprise.
Some people are pessimistic about the findings of the study. They emphasize that poor white British students are falling behind ethnic minorities. Experts have suggested that white British students are less motivated or do not have the same expectations about higher education. Others are optimistic about the findings. They believe that the study shows that immigrants want a better education for their children. Professor Alan Smithers at Buckingham University said, "Ethnic minorities value education more than the white British do." Many immigrants move to a new country with high hopes for their children. They encourage their children to do well in school. As a result, their children become more likely to go to college. But these stories, whether correct or incorrect, remain difficult to prove. In the UK, many minorities are not immigrants. Most countries in the world have difficulty educating all of their citizens. The U.S. is not immune from this problem. In the U.S., minorities, particularly Black and Hispanic students, do not do as well in school. They are less likely than white or Asian students to do well on tests. Poverty, health issues, difficult home environments, and language problems are among possible reasons. Overall, in the U.S. and the U.K., there is a similar pattern. Some minority groups score lower on tests. Students from low-income families score lower on tests. They are also less likely to go to college. Whether discrimination, poverty, or bad teaching is behind the problem, the policy question remains the same. What is the best way to improve the quality of education for children and correct for disadvantages? Researchers Greaves and Claire Crawford, PhD, used government data to follow public school students in the UK from 2002 until 2008. Each year, there were around 500,000 new students included in their study. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln did not live to see the final surrender of the armies of the Confederacy. A Confederate sympathizer shot the president at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14, 1865. By that time, however, the American Civil War really was over. General Robert E. Lee surrendered in early April, bringing an end to 4 years of fighting. Several other Confederate armies were still in the field, but they were too small and too weak to continue the fight. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Leo Scully tell the story of the final surrender of the Confederate armies.
One army was in North Carolina, commanded by General Joe Johnston. 5 days after Lee's surrender, Johnston asked for a meeting with General William Sherman, the commander of Union forces in North Carolina. Sherman met with Johnston a few days later. He offered him the same surrender terms that General Lee had accepted. He said the Confederates must give up their weapons and promise to fight no more. Then they would be free to return to their homes. Johnston said he could not accept these terms. Johnston said he had the power to surrender all the Confederate armies everywhere in the South. He said he would do so if Sherman agreed on a political settlement.
The two generals met again the next day. Sherman listened as Johnston explained his demands. Most of them Sherman accepted. He believed that President Lincoln wanted to help the South as much as possible. He had heard Lincoln say that he wanted to make it easy for the Southern states to return to the Union. When the agreement was completed, Sherman sent it immediately to Washington for approval by the new president, Andrew Johnson. The agreement seemed to give the South everything it wanted.
Instead of surrendering to Sherman, the Confederate armies would break up. The soldiers would return to their homes, taking their weapons with them. They would sign a promise not to fight again and to obey state and federal laws. In exchange for this, Sherman said the president would recognize state governments in the South which promised to support the Constitution. He said federal courts would be established in the South again. And he said the president, as well as he could, would protect the political rights promised to all people by the Constitution of the United States and the state constitutions. And Sherman said the United States government would not interfere with any of the Southern people if they remained peaceful and obeyed the laws.
President Johnson held a cabinet meeting to discuss the agreement Sherman had signed. War Secretary Stanton and the other members of the cabinet were violently opposed to it. They said Sherman had no power to make any kind of political settlement. President Johnson rejected the agreement. He said Johnston's army must surrender within 48 hours or be destroyed. He said the surrender terms could be no better than those given General Lee.
Johnston decided to surrender. On April 26th, his army laid down its weapons. One by one, the remaining armies surrendered. The soldiers began returning home. Many of them were bitter. They wanted to continue to fight. They spoke of guerrilla war against the Yankees. But most of the Confederate commanders opposed this. Many, like Cavalry General Nathan Bedford Forrest, urged their men to accept defeat. Said Forrest, in a farewell speech to his men, "It is a clear fact that we are beaten. We would be foolish to try to fight further. The government which we tried to establish is at an end. Civil war, such as you have just passed through, naturally causes feelings of bitterness and hatred. We must put these feelings aside. Whatever your responsibilities may be, meet them like men. You have been good soldiers. You can be good citizens."
Confederate President Jefferson Davis fled south after the fall of his government. He hoped to get across the Mississippi River. He believed that he could form a new Confederate army. If this failed, he planned to escape to Mexico. President Lincoln had hoped that Davis would escape. He felt that punishing Davis would only create more bitterness and make Reconstruction, the rebuilding of the South, more difficult. But President Johnson did not share Lincoln's feelings. He believed Davis had a part in the plot to kill Lincoln. He said, "Davis must be captured." On May 10th, Union forces found the Confederate president's camp in southern Georgia. They seized him and took him to Fort Monroe, Virginia. He remained there for many months under close guard. His trial was never held. And finally, in 1867, he was freed.
Late in May, 150,000 Union soldiers, representing every one of the Union armies, came to Washington. They came to take part in a big parade, a victory march through the city. For 2 days, the soldiers marched past the White House. Many of the marching men had fought at Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, Antietam, Gettysburg, Petersburg, and Appomattox. Sherman's Western Army was there from battles at Shiloh, Vicksburg, Murfreesboro, Chickamauga, and Atlanta. The soldiers marched proudly past the president and other government leaders.
All along the way, from the Capitol building to the White House, were huge crowds of cheering people. Hour after hour, the soldiers passed. Never had the city seen such a celebration. Each group of soldiers had its band and carried its own battle flags. Some proudly carried flags that had been torn in fierce fighting. Finally, late on the second day, the final group of soldiers passed the White House. The grand parade was over. The battle flags were put away, and the marching bands fell silent. The war was ended. Now, men could look about them and count the cost of the war.
4 years of bloody fighting had saved the Union of States. The Northern victory had settled for all time the question of whether states could leave the Union. And it had put to rest the great problem of slavery, which had troubled the nation for so many years. But the costs were great. More than 600,000 men of the North and South lost their lives. Hundreds of thousands more were wounded. Many had lost their arms or legs.
The war cost the North almost $3,500,000,000. It was almost as costly to the Confederates. Most of the war was fought in the southern states, and most of the war damage was there. Hundreds of cities and towns suffered damage. Some, like Atlanta, were completely destroyed by Union forces. The damage outside the populated areas was almost as great. Union armies had marched across the South, leaving behind them widespread destruction. Farmhouses and buildings had been burned, animals and crops seized or destroyed.
Transport in the South was especially hard hit. Union soldiers had destroyed most of the railroads. The few Confederate trains that escaped capture were worn out from heavy use. Riverboats had been destroyed, and roads and bridges were in terrible condition. The South had no money to rebuild. Businessmen and rich landowners had put their money in Confederate bonds, now completely worthless. Confederate war debts would never be paid. There was also the question of the 4 million former slaves. They were free now, but few could take care of themselves. They needed jobs and training.
The people of the South faced a difficult future. They had been defeated in battle. Their economy was destroyed. In many areas, there was little food, and the people were hungry. Farmers could not plant crops because they had no seed and no animals to break the ground. There was no money for rebuilding. To add to all these problems, radical Republicans in Washington were demanding severe punishment for the South. Instead of offering aid, they demanded that the government sell the property of Southerners to pay Union war debts.
President Andrew Johnson, himself a Southerner from Tennessee, opposed the radical plans. He had his own program of reconstruction for the South.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Leo Scully. Transcripts, podcasts, and historical images from our series are at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also comment on our programs. And we invite you to follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.